Okay, we're back on the first code here. We're going to do our second half of our top 10 movie list 2017. So my number five then is Blade Runner 2049, which I think in a year when we did have a lot of sequels or rebooty or kind of follow-on kind of things, was the best of them. And I think it was because really it got what was like, I'll be frank, like, there was a time in my life I would have told you that the original Blade Runner was my favorite movie of all time. I no longer believe that. The original Blade Runner creates a fascinating world, but the plot of the original Blade Runner is actually borderline incoherent if you watch it, and, like, some of the acting is not great. I'm just gonna say this, Sean Young is a terrible actress. I stand by that statement. So, you know, there are problems with the original Blade Runner, but the thing it does right is it creates a fascinating world. Blade Runner 2049 really builds on what was great about that original Blade Runner, which was that world. And in terms of Denis Villeneuve's direction, he manages to logically depict, like, what the future of that world would look like. It's, you know, even more kind of techno-dystopian and desertified and this... But he also manages to dig into the kind of thematic elements that are there in the original Blade Runner, but they're kind of, you really have to dig for them about, you know, the nature of humanity, you know, what is it to be, you know, an artificial intelligence versus a, quote, real one. Denis Villeneuve puts that front and center in this movie. And as a result, I thought that this was just both in terms of the creation of the world, but then also the story itself and the themes it deals with was one of just a really well-made, very fascinating film, and one that was did a good job of, you know, preserving the legacy of the original and in some ways improving upon it. I will say one thing is that a lot of people found the movie quite long. I felt it went by pretty quickly. I wasn't bothered by the length of it. But if you don't go into this expecting like an action sci-fi movie, it's not. There are a few action scenes and they're well done when they come up. But this is kind of a fairly slow, meditative kind of piece about, but that really like truly harder sci-fi, like not true hard sci-fi, but harder sci-fi, where it really more is about the thematic elements and the characters as well. Yeah. And also just as far as, you know, kind of similar to what we talked about with Star Wars as well, the, I won't spoil it, but there's a revelation about like who Ryan Gosling's character is, you know, within the movie that is very well played and does a lot to kind of subvert what you think is going on in the movie. So for all those reasons, Blade Runner 2049 makes it up here. It just creates a fascinating world, and it really breathes life into the characters and the story that's within it.
So I will have more to say about Blade Runner 2049 in a little bit.
Okay, so you're number four.
All right, my number four is, and actually this is the one that is a little bit weird in terms of what year we're going to say it's from. It is I, Daniel Blake, which came out in 2016 in the United Kingdom, but which only made it to North America in 2017. This is, and I mean, like, this is probably not a movie that a lot of people have heard of, so...
unless you're really into... If you're into cinema, you've probably heard of it.
I mean, yes, but, like, for your average, you know... it is about an older fella, the Daniel Blake of the type of the, you know, eponymous...
The titular Daniel Blake.
The titular Daniel Blake, who is an older fella, well, quite a senior citizen, you know, living in Britain... I guess he's a carpenter
He's a carpenter, yeah.
But who has suffered an injury that puts him, you know, out of work, unable to work for a living, and so finds himself, you know, turning to the welfare bureaucracy for survival. And I mean, really, the whole movie is like a feature length. Dramatic unraveling of how the welfare bureaucracy is horrible and dehumanizing, and just takes a look at the horrible personal toll that it has on on Daniel and on his and also on people around him, people who he knows who are also within the same system. And it's just it's an incredibly realistic film. Like,
well, you should point out it's directed by Ken Loach, who is kind of famous for making this kind of realist working class kitchen sink kind of cinema.
Yeah, and so it's incredibly well done, and I kind of feel like. I'll be honest and say part of why I have this on here is partly because of its politics. Mm. And as we alluded to, in this year of woke cinema, it has been interesting to see that at the same time that we have had the much needed and thus far underrepresented explorations of the experiences of people of color. And other oppressed groups,
women,
yes, of course. We have also managed to get a couple of films that have also taken a very interesting and sympathetic look at the conditions of the white working class, which is very much what this is.
Yeah,
I mean, one certainly gets the feeling that. If that Daniel Blake is probably if not necessarily someone who actually voted for Brexit, then certainly at least the kind of person that the campaign was aimed at. Mm-hmm. The plot of it just is at the same time that it is very driven by character and by your sympathy for Daniel Blake and for his friends and neighbors and such. Almost every single plot point, almost every forward motion in the plot is driven by just another example of how the welfare system is broken and how it just takes a punitive approach to claimants and just kind of basically assuming that everyone is out to fleece the system until proven otherwise.
Absolutely.
And how that and how that can have can put the people on the system in just horrible bureaucratic and economic nightmares. The whole thing builds towards a remarkable climax, which I think is really the last 15 minutes of the film is what you're there to see. Because it will stick with you in a way that not a lot of other movie endings will. It is a fascinating portrait of the older, less skilled, less educated, working class and how they get the shaft, really.
I really like the movie as well. I guess the reason it doesn't appear on my list is two things. One is that I think as a piece of cinema, it is a bit, I don't want to say inert, but it's a bit less than cinematic, I will put it that way. I understand this is what Ken Loach does, but I think other movies have managed to balance that idea of being realistic, but while also having something more going on visually and that kind of thing. The other thing is, and I don't want to spoil it, but there is a twist that happens, because the one thing you didn't really mention is that there's another major character in the movie who's a woman with children that Daniel Blake becomes friends with, because they're both in a similarly frustrating situation with the welfare bureaucracy. And there's some twists with her story towards about the two-thirds mark of the movie that led to me as a bit cheap and a bit kind of I'm sure people – listen, I know that people get put in situations like that. But to me, to kind of throw the elements that they do in without maybe building them up a little more, felt like a kind of cheap dramatic ploy. And so that was my one reservation about the movie. Nevertheless, I think a really well done film. Although of the two things that Ken Loach directed this year, it may actually be the lesser of the two, because he also made the really good Jeremy Corbyn labor advertisement that people were throwing around. So nevertheless, it comes from the same spirit. I really enjoyed Daniel Blake. I feel like there was just a couple of things that put me off about it. But definitely, if you like Ken Loach, his movies before, you'd like this as well. And if you are interested in seeing this thing, and I should, you know, one thing I would point out is that the movie is actually funny. Like, it's not just constant grinding misery. Daniel Blake is actually a really likable, upbeat kind of guy. But it really shows how somebody who is like that can be, like, ground down by the horrible wheels of, like, a welfare bureaucracy. And if you've ever worked in a welfare bureaucracy like I have, you will also probably find this movie equal parts fascinating and infuriating. So, anyway, really, really good movie. Just had a couple of issues with it. So my number four, which is probably as big a swerve as can be possible, is John Wick Chapter 2. Just, oh my God, he kills the guy with the pencil. Like, what more do you want, people? Like,
Heath Ledger's Joker, eat your heart out.
Like, I'll just be frank. Like, there are some movies where I have a very visceral reaction to them, and, you know, it's my lizard brain just, like, firing on all cylinders. John Wick was the movie this year that did that the most to me. That's not to say that I think it's a stupid movie or a movie that I think was made carelessly. It is not. As far as, like, creating a sort of comic booky kind of world that it, you know, is its own original creation. It does a lot to really deepen what were kind of the shoots of that in the original John Wick that they couldn't really elaborate on because of budget concerns. Now they have, you know, all the money that they need to really bring you into this world. And it does the thing that a good sequel is supposed to do, which is it elaborates on the world of the original while also doing some new and innovative things. As far as action, these are the best action scenes in cinema this year, and really innovative and different each time they come up. Like, it's not just constantly, you know, Keanu breaking people's arms or shooting them. Like, there's a really great scene of a kind of sniper, not sniper, but a gun battle between him and Common, where they have to kind of try to kill each other in the middle of this kind of, like, ritzy Eurotrash party, but they can't. They have to do it without any of the guests noticing, which is just really
done. It is the, like, stealthiest, low-keyest gunfight you will see in a movie this year.
Yeah. And just scene after scene of things like that, just new and incredible and innovative ways to destroy the human body. And also just a really fascinating universe, this whole, you know, because the whole premise of it is that John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, is, you know, part of this guild, of this kind of worldwide network, I guess, of assassins. And he gets pulled back into it because he owes a blood debt to this guy who was part of the Italian, I think he was part of the Camorra. And, an organized crime syndicate. And basically says, okay, you do one last job for me and then you're done kind of thing. And, of course, you know, anytime anyone says in a movie you're going to do one last job, you're never going to do one last job, folks. But what it does is it manages to depict this world. And, again, it's that show, don't tell. They tell you a little bit, but you can tell by the relationships that people have each other, like, what the rules of this world of assassins is and how the relationships between these characters are formed in that world. And I also just think that, like, you know, you could argue that this is a limited range of acting, but I think Keanu is actually really, really good at depicting this character as this kind of, like, unstoppable badass who is just like, oh my God. Now, the one thing I will say about the movie that maybe it suffers from in comparison to the original, it doesn't have as many lines where people are just like, it's John Wick, oh, I'm just dead now, like, I can't. So the constant saying of, like, John Wick is coming, oh my God, was the, you know, the thing that I really liked about the original. But he is, I will give Keanu a lot of credit in that he is, like, physically really willing to get into it with these roles, and you can tell that he has actually studied martial arts and all these kinds of things. So, again, if you don't like action movies, you won't like this. But just as far as a movie that I thought was – the most visceral, that did the most to create its world, and that did the most to really convince me that people that were, you know, working on it really crafted this with a lot of love and a lot of heart, and a lot of, like, you know, knowledge of, like, trashy 90s, like, cinema, which this is an obvious tribute to. I really, really like this movie. I had a smile on my face throughout.
Oh, yeah. No, this, and it did not make my top 10. So I'm here's the part where I say the happy things before I drive the stake in. It is, like, I would say it is the best, like, true action movie.
Yeah.
Like just action as kind of, like, without any,
like,
other,
of the point of it is the action.
Yeah. The best, like, pure action movie this year. And yeah, like you say, like, it is like, you know, people often have the you know, almost no one is ever excited for a sequel and expecting the sequel to be, like, you know, everyone always expects a sequel to be bad,
or at least worse than the original.
Whereas this is, like, this is a good sequel. Like, this is, like, you could teach a course on how to make sequels just by showing the original and then John Wick Chapter 2, because it just does such a great job of taking the action from the original and doing new interesting things with it, of developing the world and taking what was, you know, originally just kind of a small, you know, snatch of it that you get to see, like, in terms of the sort of underground, you know, international cartel of assassins, and you know, really expanding that into something fully fleshed out and that you know can travel, if you will. But the one thing that I'm right with Carter. Like, I was watching this movie, and, like, there were some scenes, I particularly some of just the set pieces of just the like, not just the action, but the way they sync it up with music and with just some really amazing visuals, like even just like where they set some of these
color and lighting and set dressing.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, oh my God, like, the settings of this movie's fight scenes are so far above the previous one, with which, you know,
mostly takes place in, like, parking garages,
and ends with you know, him having a fight with a soggy Paul Krugman lookalike on some dock somewhere.
Yeah.
But I will say that, you know, this is the part where I turn all, you know, arch snooty film critic and just kind of say that as much as I like really enjoyed it and it is a viscerally pleasing film, was like, once I got near the end of the year and I started thinking back and I was just like, they're just, and I mean, not that they even set out to be, so, like, maybe it is unfair to judge it on these terms, but just beneath all the you know, well crafted world and the action, there's just not that much to it. Like, it's a pretty slight movie in that way.
I learned that you don't piss off Keanu Reeves.
Yes, that is an important theme to fear Keanu Reeves, absolutely. And so it just didn't have enough substance. And there is one other thing, which is that the ending is like, and I mean, like, look, I'm not that angry about it because I am totally going to go see the next movie, but the ending is one of the most egregious sequel tease cliffhangers of the year, to the point where before the credits rolled, they might as well just have said, John Wick will return in, you know,
Chapter 2.
Yeah, in whatever the title of the third movie is going to be.
Yeah, no, that's all fair. I guess as far as the ending goes, I was just like, hell yeah, I'm coming back for it. So I didn't really mind that much. But I understand, like, this is a thing that's kind of, I think, as much about the evaluative metrics that we're each using.
Yeah, it's just, particularly what bothered me about the ending is that, like, I think to be truly great, any film has to some extent be able to stand on its own.
Fair.
And like the ending just completely cuts the legs out of the, well, maybe not completely, but it like, makes it like extremely obvious that it's like you're gonna have to see the third movie to get the full
comeback audiences. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
No, that's fair. That's fair. So you're number three then.
My number three is, well, yeah, actually it's Blade Runner 2049.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, Carter already said a lot about this movie and why it's really great. Came to the cult of Blade Runner, of the original Blade Runner, I think more recently than Carter did.
Yeah.
But I came to it long enough ago that I was psyched all to hell when I first heard, or well, maybe that's where that I was deeply, deeply intrigued when I heard they were making this movie. Yeah. Intrigued and worried that it might be bad.
Yeah.
And then I learned that Denis Villeneuve, one of my favorite
We should say has previously made Arrival and Sicario
and a number of Quebecois movies that you have not seen but absolutely should.
Yes.
And I love Denis Villeneuve. Like I'll just come out and say I think Denis Villeneuve may be my favorite filmmaker currently working. That's for me personally.
Certainly amongst newer filmmakers.
Yeah, so. He did it.
Yeah.
He pulled it off. He took what could have been like one of the most unnecessary sequels in the history of film franchising, and he actually made something that feels like an organic continuation of the original Blade Runner, and that actually to return to the criterion I just laid out for the previous movie, that I think also, minus maybe some emotional resonance that some reveals would lose, can also to almost stand on its own.
Yeah.
As a self-contained story, and it's just, I mean, it, like, when this movie came out, Radio-Canada was just in love with the fact that a Quebecois filmmaker was making this, and they actually dug up this thing that apparently Denis Villeneuve participated in, like a Young Filmmakers Challenge, like 20 years ago. In which he actually used the music from the original Blade Runner. So you can there is evidence that like this is the movie I think Denis Villeneuve has been waiting his whole life to make, and it shows just in the way that he gets both the aesthetic and the themes of Blade Runner and is able to adapt them. And I also do think that just in terms of some of the themes that it explores, like the themes and the cinematography, like there are some things as I was watching this movie the very first time, I saw something and I was like, this to me is like instantly iconic. I can already see that like 10 years later, I'm going to look back and be like, this was one of the definitive like scenes of like mid 2010 sci-fi. Mm-hmm. I'll try not to spoil it too much, but there is one scene that more subtly and in a more artistically well realized way brings across these sort of asymmetrical realities of drone warfare. That just makes the entirety of Good Kill fucking redundant. And man, that's if you haven't seen Good Kill, you're not gonna get that. But
and don't see Good Kill because it's not a very good movie.
Yeah. Now I will address one thing, which is and I do feel like I. Part of why I love some movies so much is because I also want to engage in the larger discussions that they become a part of socially. And there was quite a backlash to this film in terms of its female characters and its depictions of women. And so I will say that I totally understand where that's coming from. And like, you know, yeah, like the women in this movie are due to a large extent exist like in relation to, you know, Ryan Gosling's character. And you know, some of them are not very well developed. And you know, certainly we, in the wake of, you know, I think what are some like comparable films in terms of their place in the culture, like say Mad Max Fury Road, you know, it's, I definitely think that that is something where Denis Villeneuve maybe could have done better. But at the same time, I do think that there are some things that about the film's depiction of women that can come down to a matter of interpretation. Like there is, there is one character who, you know, who is basically futuristic Siri,
yeah,
stroke, like
the thing from
her. If it had like a
corporeal form.
Yeah. That, you know, if you accept it, if you take that character at face value and take it, particularly her relationship with Ryan Gosling's character, at face value, like, yeah, I mean, she is like the you know, an extremely reductive stereotype. But I do also think that there is enough within the movie to support a much more subversive reading of that character and the gender dynamic that that she has with Ryan Gosling's character. So I think that it is kind of a mixed bag there. And the one thing that the one criticism of the movie that I am unable to get past is that I don't want to say too much because like talking about this also does maybe to some extent involve spoiling part of the film, but I will just say that there is, if you've seen the original movie and we're talking about like gender dynamics, there is one thing in the original movie which is really just pretty egregious in that respect, and that is actually mm-hmm. pretty central to the plot of the original movie. Mm-hmm. And the way that they kind of the sort of past that this movie constructs for itself can be kind of read as whitewashing that part of the original movie and kind of the nature of the relationship between you know Deckard and Rachel. So that is a criticism that I am unable to rebut and that I think is quite valid. But for all the reasons that both Carter and I have said, I feel that there is enough redemptive virtue in this movie that I just still think it's great and it will be well remembered going forward.
I agree with all that. I think I've sort of said my piece on it. So my number three then is Dunkirk, which you talked about previously.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, I think, you know, what you say about the movie and why it wasn't higher for you is absolutely true. The film is, you know, cold and clinical to a certain degree. And I also think that, you know, if you're not interested in a depiction of war on film, I don't think this movie is going to do much for you because it is very restricted in terms of what it is about. It is about the Dunkirk evacuation. Like, there is almost no surrounding context of what commanders are doing about Thanksgiving. It is very much about the people in that moment, whether they
need to use a cliche phrase. It is a very boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Show a yeah. depiction of warfare.
Yeah, so wings in the air, as it were. So the but in doing that, I think what Christopher Nolan managed to get across is convey the, you know, both the, you know, the horror of war in a general sense of, you know, the chaotic nature, but also the kind of the way he uses time really managed to convey that particular anxiety that was felt amongst the people at the time of like, you know, we only have this much to do, and like there's points at which the soldiers are literally just standing on the beach, like waiting for the ships to get to them, and this kind of thing. So it really manages to use that, you know, kind of temporal thing, which basically is that each of the stories run at different time speeds, basically, which could be a really annoying kind of gimmick. But the way he manages to weave them together really speaks to his skill as a filmmaker, because it puts you in the position of feeling temporally different depending on which set of characters that you're following. Like, you in the section with the soldiers, you do feel like it's slower, it's more grinding, it is a lot of waiting around. Whereas, like, when you're with Tom Hardy in the plane, it really does feel like everything is moving really fast, and, like, you know, you're almost being overwhelmed by how much is coming at you sensorily. So I think he manages to convey perspectives on war from different people who are involved in it, and use that gimmick of time as a really good way of illustrating the different comedic perspectives he's coming mm-hmm. from. Aside from all of that, just really well done action, really visceral in terms of the sound design and the use of cinematography, all that kind of thing. And I also thought the performances managed to convey as much as they need to about these characters without, with, as you said, minimal amounts of dialogue. And, you know, honestly, you know, a revelation, Harry Styles, who knew? Great.
Yeah, hey.
You know, he's a good actor. So I was really impressed and surprised by this movie. Not that I went in with low expectations, but I was one of the people who was kind of iffy on Interstellar. And I think this is, in certain ways, a return to form for Christopher Nolan. So a movie that I really appreciated, and I thought did everything that it set out to do very well.
I do think you make an interesting point, particularly how you refer to, like, the differing time scales and, like, the sort of sense of, like, powerlessness that it conveys of the soldiers sitting on the beach at Dunkirk. This movie, there's a famous quote, I have no friggin' idea who it's by, but that, you know, war is months of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. And I feel like perhaps no movie since, I don't know, maybe Gallipoli has captured that aspect of war as well as Dunkirk does. So that is something to its credit, absolutely.
Okay, so you're number two then.
My number two is Get Out.
It's also my number two.
Ah, there you go. There you go. So, okay. Get Out. I mean, you know, if you haven't already seen this movie, what is wrong with you? But also, yeah, no, like, it is a revelation of, like, who knew Jordan Peele was, like, this amazing a filmmaker? Like, how do you make something this good in your first turn?
That's not actually true. It's not his debut feature. He and Key and Peele made a movie called Keanu.
Okay.
Which was kind of a comedy movie, but nevertheless, it's the first movie he's in that he does
solo.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Okay, fine. It's amazing.
I mean, no, I'm just correcting.
But yes, okay, fine. You're right about that.
Yeah.
And it is just such a it is such a movie that, you know, at the same time manages to kind of mine, like, broad appeal in terms of the sort of, like, genre horror movie elements mm-hmm. that it has, while also speaking to something that is, you know, an experience of Black people in. Well, in the United States and probably in Canada and other Western countries as well, mm-hmm. In a way that speaks directly to their experience and can hopefully, not literally. I mean, I freaking hope it's not, but you get what I mean.
I know. I'm just.
And, you know, yeah, I mean, like, and it's, like, it's really good, the kind of, and I mean, even though, like, I'll say, like, I found that the way it was constructed is also, like, there are other things that, like, I truly, what I think is great about this is the synthesis of the, like, hyper-specific sort of political point and the sort of, like, social point it's trying to make. with the like parts that give it much broader appeal. And then like I'll say that like even like so like yes, obviously like being a person of color in a like white thing in a white milieu is an experience it refers to that I have no ability to relate to personally, but that like also like it does also on some level address that sort of awkward sense of like, you know, meeting your partner's parents for the first time, and particularly if you're, you know, going out of town and kind of maybe feeling a little
different social milieu.
Yeah, and maybe yeah, and like that just that kind of weird feeling of like, you know, it being like just you and your partner that like and like not anyone else you like really know all that well, that almost that sense of like isolation.
Yeah.
And just the way that it just builds so naturally.
Yes.
From the little hints of discomfort and isolation and racism and all the other sort of bad things, and the way it builds gradually but inexorably to the like
revelation of what is actually going on. From my perspective on this, and look, like I again, the white guys talking about movies here. I guess what I liked about it was that it managed to do all of those things and make all those sorts of sociopolitical points while also playing on what you as an audience member know about horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And how horror movies work mechanically. And I think you can tell that Jordan Peele is a really big fan, or at least has watched a lot of those movies, because he manages to use those tropes of, like, something's up here, bro, like, get out, get out. You know, but he manages to do it in a way of, like, because, you know, there is this thing that, you know, what he is really talking about here is the sense that something is not right, but you're just going to go along with it anyway because, okay, they probably mean well.
Yeah.
And what he manages to do is draw that a connection between that trope in a horror movie and the experience that he's describing of being African American. And I think that is a something that could very easily like come off as like either I don't want to say exaggerated, but it could come off as cheap or trite or something. And he manages to do it very perfectly because he manages to you know, at the beginning of the movie really convey this sense of vague discomfort, but there's a level of comedy to it, and there's a level of like, oh, you know, haha, isn't it funny, you know, how ignorant these, you know, like, white liberal people are, you know,
yeah,
haha, kind of thing. But then he says, like, no, like, actually, there's something terrible going on here. And also I want to shout out probably the best side character in any movie this year, his buddy, the TSA agent, who just does throughout the movie, he kind of serves as a sort of audience proxy, who is just constantly calling Chris and being like, you're crazy, you leave. Like, he's saying all the things that you want to say to Chris in the movie, which is I think is just kind of a really good thing that Jordan Peele included. Yeah, and even just as far as the technical merits of the movie, I think it's very well directed, I think it's very well acted, and what is really good is the casting, because he manages to kind of play on your impressions about these actors from previous roles that they had. Obviously, Allison Williams from Girls, who, you know, I'm sure is a lovely person in real life, but nevertheless is like, she's definitely mining your impression of her as Marty. For this role. And also, and I can never remember his name, but he was Hubert Humphrey in All the Way, but he's most well known for West Wing, the man who plays the father.
Bradley Whitford
as her father in the movie is really good as well, doing a similar kind of thing. Yeah, and I mean, I think this is the movie definitely that got the people the most talking in 2017 about what it was saying, about you know, what the realities it was speaking to were. The one negative thing I will say about it, if I have to say a negative thing, is that towards the end of the movie, when it becomes the kind of, you know, action, get out, horror stuff, Chris becomes the Terminator, basically. And, like, I understand that's a mechanical thing in horror movies, like, and there was really no way around it, but, like, he could have done more, I guess, to build that this character was capable of some of these things going on. And I think, and some critics I've read, you know, and I should say African-American critics I've read have said that, like, they felt uncomfortable with that because it was kind of indulging in a violent black man sort of stereotype. I think Jordan Peele has answered those criticisms reasonably. But and again, you know, I'm not the person to say who's right or wrong here, but it is just something that I felt, and then I, you know, also other people felt. Mm-hmm. So one negative about the movie, but nevertheless, I felt that this movie was using mechanics and tropes from something very familiar in a totally new and unexpected way. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I like Key and Peele's show. I thought that he's a very funny guy previously. I didn't think he had it in him to both make a pretty stinging sociological commentary and a really good horror movie in one package. But nevertheless, he did, and I think full credit to him for doing it.
Yeah, and I will say, touch a little bit on what you said right there at the end. Like, part of why this is not number one for me, and indeed I'll admit that when I first saw the movie, my reaction was actually a little more mixed, is that I do feel that once you find out what's going on and it becomes a more straightforward horror movie, it's like the last act is not as good as the build-up.
So yes, I mean, I think the last act is where most becomes a conventional horror movie.
Yeah, and kind of loses what makes it special. So there is that is a slight issue, but it's still such an astoundingly good and original movie that if you haven't already, you've got to see it.
Absolutely. So now we come to the end. Your number one film of 2017.
My number one film is The Big Sick.
That's so funny. It's also my number one.
Yeah.
So there you go.
There you go.
What a coincidence, The Big Sick. Well, I'll let you start because I kind of, yeah, so I'll let you start.
Hopefully you've already heard of this movie. If you haven't, it is, and again, like speaking of like kind of auteurist, like personal works, this
the most personal thing possible.
Yeah, in that this is literally a dramatization of how Kumail Nanjiani met his wife.
Yeah,
and like how their relationship got started,
yeah.
Which just happened to intersect perfectly with her coming down with a serious illness and being like incapacitated to the point where like her parents had to like come to Chicago and look after her. Thus The Big Sick. And it is just such a, so I guess I'll just get right to the core of it. What I loved about this movie was that it is just so radically honest and realistic about everything that it touches on. Because again, we're talking about, you know, the year of woke cinema, which is that's 2017, people. It touches on Islamophobia. It also touches on, you know, some of the, you know, the very conservative and restrictive interpretation of Islam that some Muslims have, and how that can affect, you know, them and their family and most particularly their children. You know, it touches on like the immigrant experience in America. It touches on so many things, and it is what to my mind just remarkable how honest it is, and in touching on these hot button issues, how it diligently avoids bringing any of them to the kind of trite feel good resolution that I feel most movies would try to milk out of them. Maybe spoil a little bit. I mean, like his family is, you know, in the movie pressuring him to to date and ultimately take as his wife a Pakistani, a Muslim woman.
Yeah.
They absolutely do not want him, to end up with a woman who is not Muslim.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he ends up with what's the character's movie in the
Her name is Emily in the movie, and I apologize for that, but she's not. I should say that in the movie, Kumail Nanjiani plays himself. His wife is not played by the actual woman. She's played by Zoe Kazan in the movie.
So naturally the fact that he ends up with this white woman with Emily in the movie, is not what they want.
Yeah.
And again, like I feel like your kind of typical Hollywood movie would kind of end with and again, like I don't want to give away too much, but would just end with
everybody's
happy and everybody reconciles the family learns that they have to accept the way things are in America and give him his freedom, but he also needs to learn to respect his family more.
Yeah.
And where it ends up with is much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And it again does the same thing in terms of the relationship between Kumail and Emily's parents,
mm-hmm.
in the way that
who are, we should say, played by Helen Hunt and Ray Romano in surprisingly great performance. Maybe not surprising in the case of Helen Hunt, surprising in the case of Ray Romano.
Yeah, Ray Romano, everybody loves Raymond's Ray Romano. And he is astounding in this.
He's I think we should point out, is it may not be obvious, this is a romantic comedy. In form.
Yes.
It's just that, unlike most movies that you would give that title to, it is reliant, because it is a dramatization of a literal, real relationship. It is much messier, much more complicated, much more real, and much more lived in than any of those other things. But it is also incredibly funny and well-written, because both Kumail Nanjiani and his wife are, comedy writers by trade.
Yeah.
So it is so, as you say, both honest but also really funny, and also really manages to convey this idea of, how – because I think what the central point of the movie is he and her in this relationship – but then she gets a sickness, and he kind of – and she gets it in the movie when he and her are kind of in a falling out period.
Yeah.
But he sort of comes to, I guess you would say, love and appreciate her more by meeting her parents and meeting the people around her and learning about her that way, kind of thing, which sounds kind of corny and cheesy, but the way it's done in the movie is just so – pitch perfect, and it never goes to being too melodramatic, but never goes to being too overtly comedic, and it's just so well realized and just so well depicted, and just so I just want to say it's a very honest film about these things, and it's also honest about the depiction of living as a kind of millennial freelancer in downtown Chicago, and the trials and tribulations that come with that. And, Kumail Nanjiani's, attempt to create a stand-up and an improv kind of career, and just balancing all these different aspects of one's life and trying to find love in that way. And I was I read good reviews about this movie going in. I was honestly blown away by how much I liked it when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I was, expecting okay things, and I like Kumail Nanjiani. You're probably most well-known from Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
Which is, a pretty good show, but I was just so impressed by this, really, really was. And as far as touching on the issues that it does, I mean, I think, in a year which has been characterized by so much terrible things happening, I think that this movie managed to deal with those issues, but ultimately come out with a sense of very, realistic. But again, I want to come back to that idea of it earns the hopeful ending that it has.
Absolutely.
It ends on a nice note, but it doesn't end on a note where everything is resolved. It ends on a note of opening and possibility. And that's what I think is potentially the best thing about it.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is just such an. And I just like, you know, like I want to say it's not necessarily the movie that I came out of being the most wowed or that, you know, I can't like point to like a specific scene and say this is like instantly iconic the way the, well quite to the same extent that I can with the other movies. Like if I break it down, it's not, you know, but it is just such a well-rounded movie and just so well done that I just like it just sticks with me. Like I no matter how much I try to like find something wrong with it and critically evaluate that, it is just like such an excellent movie that I can find, and I can find so little fault with it that I really think it earns the number one spot.
I absolutely agree. Final note, contains the best 9/11 joke I've heard in several years. I will leave it to you to discover what that is.
It's
a hell of a joke, folks.
It's honestly probably the best 9/11 joke I've heard, period.
Anyway. Let that be your guide. If nothing else, it has a pretty fantastic 9/11 joke. Anyway, so we come to the end of the list. I do have a list of some upcoming movies in 2018 that I am anticipating. I'll just kind of rattle these off, and if you have kind of impressions or maybe things you don't see on here that you want to talk about as far as what we are looking forward to next year. So I'm just going to – these are in the order of release. I got this from IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
So one is The Commuter. That's the new Liam Neeson Kills Everybody movie, mainly just because I like those movies. What do you want, folks?
No, actually, I have come around to a similar – low level appreciation.
I probably will go see that. There's a new Cloverfield movie coming out. There's not really a whole lot of information about, typically, as typical with Cloverfield. You know, I'm interested. Black Panther, of course. You know, Ryan Coogler, I think, did a really good job with Creed. That was a surprise for me in 2016. And yeah, I mean, it's Black Panther. It's Black Panther. You know, and they got Top Dog Entertainment to do the soundtrack. Kendrick Lamar and Al. There's a new movie by Alex Garland called Annihilation with Natalie Portman in it, which is it looks interesting. It's a sci-fi film. I may or may not actually go see this, but I'm curious to know what is happening in Tomb Raider Uprising. Or no, Tomb Raider. Alicia McConder, Tomb Raider. I don't know. Tomb Raider could be a good movie eventually.
I just
in the same way that I think you saw Assassin's Creed, I might go see this. Just
okay, fair enough.
Because I thought the newest Tomb Raider game was actually quite good. Appears to be based on that. Anyway, one day we will get a good video game movie.
God, just cross your fingers, people.
The trailer for this does not look very good, but I will probably go see it anyway because of the pedigree behind it is Pacific Rim Uprising.
Oh, yeah.
I really like the original. Unfortunately, this looks like a classic case of, like, the budget being slashed through the sequel. Nevertheless, it will have giant robots fighting giant monsters, so if nothing else, we can
look for. And it has John Boyega.
And it has John Boyega, so we'll see. This movie is probably going to be terrible, but, like, I feel like I need to see it as Ready Player One. You know, a lot of people... I read that book years ago, and I thought it was okay. I haven't gone back and read it now, and I might hate it now because of the way it's written. But I also think, like, I don't know, it'll either be, like, good, or if it's bad, it'll probably be the interesting kind of bad, where it's just, like, you know, I'm shotgun blasting, like, you know, nostalgia triggers at you to, like, so I don't know.
One of the trailers for it makes extensive use of Rush's Tom Sawyer, and you cannot, I mean, that is just, like, laser targeted right at appealing to me. So, you know what, marketing team, you did your job. I'll go see the movie, but I do not necessarily go in with the highest of expectations.
Yeah. Next one that I am actually quite intrigued by is New Mutants, which is a movie in the X-Men franchise, but they're making it, and if you've seen the trailer, it appears to be doing pretty well, is making it as a straight horror movie. Because it's basically set in, like, a psychiatric institution for mutants. I'm on board with that, like, interesting kind of alternative takes about things in the X-Men universe, similar to Logan being a Western.
I'm particularly interested. I mean, I actually have only, in fact, I only heard about this being a thing, like, today or yesterday. Okay. So I'm really behind it. So you say he's in a psychiatric...
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, the X-Men are such a fascinatingly malleable property in terms of their ability to sort of slot in and represent any number of sort of, you know, oppressed groups. So I'm going to be interested to see what, you know, X-Men in a psychiatric institution looks like.
Yeah. And the next one, which, you know, everyone will probably go see, is Avengers Infinity War. I will note that I do think that the trailer looks like kind of a mess in terms of, like, just throwing all these different things in. But nevertheless, I mean, I generally trust the Marvel movies to be at least okay. So
I mean, we've been building towards this. We're finally going to see Josh Brolin as Thanos.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel obliged to see it.
Yeah, they've got me in. Next one, which has had some kind of behind the scenes stuff, which isn't too encouraging, but nevertheless, Solo, the new Star Wars spinoff movie. For those of you who don't know, originally Christopher Miller and Phil Lord, who directed the Lego movie, were supposed to make this, but then there was some wrangling, I don't know what exactly happened, and now Ron Howard is finishing it. So we'll see. And apparently this is like basically going to be a straight comedy, or at least like an action comedy. So, you know, we'll see. I liked Rogue One, so I'm definitely on board with the idea of like doing totally different takes on the Star Wars universe, but some of the background has maybe not got the greatest notice. Next one, Deadpool 2. Is Deadpool, folks. I like the original.
Yeah, I mean, what more do you really need
you know,
to say?
I think, you know, we'll see on that. Next one is kind of an interesting one, The Purge, The Island. The Purge movies started out being a waste of a really good premise on a terrible home invasion thriller, and gradually became...
Wait, there's a new Purge movie?
Yes, there is.
But
they have gradually evolved to being very interesting sort of political action cinema. Last one in particular, Purge Election Year, was maybe it was foretelling things that we should have noticed at the time. But anyway, so I'm on board for a new Purge movie. Next one, you know, it's another Marvel, Ant-Man and the Wasp. I like the first Ant-Man. I thought it did some interesting things. So you know that one's in there. One that has been, you know, kind of cooking for a very long time and is now finally seeing releases, Alita Battle Angel, which is based on the Battle Angel Alita manga series. This has been a long-time pet project of James Cameron. He's still producing it, but actually directing it is going to be Robert Rodriguez. So I'm on board for this. The trailer for it looked interesting. A lot of people complained about the look of Alita, like having the anime eyes in the trailer, even though everybody else doesn't. You know, I'm okay with that. I'm interested to see what they do with it. The next one is Shane Black is making a Predator movie. So hell yeah, I mean I'm on board. It's the Predator and Shane Black. That could be something interesting.
Sure, why not?
X-Men Dark Phoenix, although this may or may not actually come out next year because of Bryan Singer is a horrible human being and is being canned from the project. So this may or may not actually come out next year, but anyway, if it does, I will go see it because X-Men. Creed 2, new Creed. Mm-hmm. First one, surprisingly, a good entry in the Rocky series. I'm interested to see where they go with it now.
And now it's like it's about like Drago's son, right?
Yes, it's about Drago's son facing off with Creed.
I'm going to be... You know, are we getting a new Rocky IV to go for this new Cold War?
Maybe.
Because, like, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. If I can change, and you can change, then I can hack your election. I got nothing, folks. Next one, which is the sequel to Wreck-It Ralph, which I really enjoyed. I thought was a really interesting depiction of, like, old-school video games on film. It's called Ralph Breaks the Internet. A title that is off-putting, but nevertheless,
We are making the hand gesture as we say this.
Yes. And then finally, I have a movie that is incredibly unnecessary, but I will nevertheless go see, is Sicario 2 Soldado, which... Listen, folks, Sicario did not need a sequel. However, I am on board with this, if only because Taron Sheridan is writing it.
Yeah.
So at the very least, and he did, I read an interview with him where he said, well, it's not really a sequel. It just kind of takes place in the same universe, and he's doing something different tonally with it. So I'm on board with it. And if nothing else, we will get to see Benicio del Toro back from the previous film and, you know, him shooting everybody, so that would be
fun. Yeah, I mean, like...
A movie that never needed to be made, but, like...
Like, you know, if you're going to expand on one thing from Sicario, which you shouldn't...
Yes.
But if you are going... If you are going to, and there's nothing I can say to stop you, at least you picked an interesting part of the movie to expand on, which was Benicio del Toro's character.
Absolutely. So yeah, that's my anticipation.
Okay, I literally didn't even think of this. So you might have heard slight sounds of panic when Carter started reading his list. But there is, okay, but I have managed to scramble one movie that does sound kind of interesting to me that I have heard about. I think it's coming out. It's called The Public.
Okay.
Have you heard about this one?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so it is written and directed by Emilio Estevez, aka the brother of Charlie Sheen, son of...
The Mighty Ducks' Emilio Estevez.
Yes, Emilio Estevez. And it is a movie about, basically, it's set in Chicago, or... God, Cincinnati. Okay. I'm terribly sorry to the people of Cincinnati for confusing your city with Chicago. During like, well, actually, kind of what we've been having in here in Ottawa, an Arctic like cold snap, where basically, as I understand it, a group of homeless people occupy the public library as basically the only place to find shelter from.
So is this based on actual incident or is it a...
I am unclear on that. Okay. But yeah, so okay, I mean, sounds, so, you know, yeah. And I mean, that's really all I know about it thus far, but I'm very interested to see,
Emilio might be coming with it in 2018.
Yeah, so The Public, that's my anticipated.
Okay, there you go. So with all that being said, and we got through these lists, I think we talked about some really great movies this year. Do you have anything that you want to close on in terms of a final thought? Or?
I mean, it's just the same thought I've been putting forward, is I just think this was a really interesting year. And just particularly when I say that like it was the year of woke cinema, like responding to Trump, I just think it's kind of interesting that we're like, we're not even 1 year into Trump, and we're already getting these movies that are digging into issues of race and of gender in America. Whereas it's just like, I don't know, like it's not like in 2002 we got a whole bunch of movies about like Islamophobia and the war on terror or whatever. So I think it's particularly interesting, like, and I think potentially salutary, the like conversations some of these movies can spark. And I also just think it's kind of a historical curiosity of like the amazing turnaround with which we've gone from like real world events to like discussing these same issues in film.
I think some of that is partially because, you know, a lot of these movements that these are speaking to really predate Trump. Like obviously things like Get Out is, you know, obviously speaking to things from Black Lives Matter and that kind of thing. So, I mean, definitely, you know, there's a longer tail, but at the very least, this is really the year where the fuse on the dynamite really, you know, reach the plunger or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I think, you know, movies this year really spoke to a lot of different issues, and I think our lists, you know, at least attempted to represent that. Also, movies where you kill someone with a pencil, that was also a thing that happened this year. So, you know, whatever your poison was, it was a year where you couldn't get in. And I think this was a really, really strong year for
someone. I agree.
Okay. So with that note, we'll leave you. As always, our email is theferriscode@gmail.com, blogspot, theferriscode.blogspot.com, where we have links to everything that we talked about today. And subscribe on Twitter and follow us on Facebook. And on iTunes as well. And as always, I thank you for listening, and I hope you have a pleasant time until the next time we talk.